going to present a work that actually has been developed mostly 3 years ago, but it dates back, parts of it, probably more than 20 years ago. Actually, it touches the different topics I've been working on. There would be some Dupierre equation, by the way, yeah, in it, so a very small, very short recap of the local volatility model. But to explain how to, this talk is working, actually, we should probably go backwards. So to start from the real practical issue I was trying to solve some time ago, and to see how it led to more theoretical concerns. So the precise problem I was addressing many years ago, it was to know how to compute the optimal hedge of path-dependent options with path-independent option, so European option or vanilla options, if you want. And a natural idea is to conduct a perturbative analysis, so to see, okay, what is the volatility risk associated to a certain strike and maturity. Natural idea is to bump properly around the strike and maturity, the implied volatility surface, and to reprice your option and to see what is the impact on the price, and to repeat it through all strikes and maturities to get a decomposition of the vega risk, volatility risk, across the strikes and maturities. To conduct this perturbative analysis, so I used something I had been doing for some time before, which was to compute the price, the difference of price between two models by doing a sort of a trader trick, which is you consider that you believe that the model is a kind of a simple one and that your software revalues it every day within a simple set of assumptions, but you realize that actually the real dynamics is different. So this is introducing a tracking error, variations in your P&L along each path, and when you take the average over all possible paths, actually it will give you the difference of price between those two models. But to be able to conduct this P&L analysis, so what I was doing at the time, it was back in 96, 97, I was basically pretending that the Black-Scholes PDE for European type options was actually valid in the case of path-dependent options. So if you're a trader and you sell, for instance, an Asian option, it's quite intuitive that if you delta hedge it, first you have to define the delta properly, but if you delta hedge it, you will pick up some gamma at the delta hedge position, will have two break-even points located one standard deviation away, which is the main result of the classical Black-Scholes PDE for European options. So it seemed to be very intuitive that it should work for path-dependent options. But I was not considering there would be any issue with respect to this. And it's many years later that I realized that actually it was not so obvious and it had not been established. And that to establish it properly, it was very natural to extend the Ito calculus to path-dependent options through the definition of some partial derivatives, functional derivatives, and that I'm going to present. So I started from this very practical problem of knowing how to optimally hedge these path-dependent options with vanilla options, and it led to a rather theoretical piece of work, which I named, so it was at the end of 2008, so functional Ito calculus was a SSRN paper in 2009. So, as often, actually the order of exposition will be totally inverted, so we'll start from the theory and move to the applications. So we'll start with a basic concept of the functional Ito formula. We will show that it's possible to have a path-dependent version of the Feynman-Katz equation. So functional in two senses. One is that it will apply actually to path dependent payoffs and also to path dependent dynamics. And this will give amongst other things, an explicit representation of the integrand in the Martingale representation theorem, a kind of alternative to the Clark-Cocon formula, and a partial differential equation in the functional sense for path-dependent options. So in the second part, we are going to move to the application, to the optimal hedge in terms of volatility. First, going very quickly through some basic facts of the local vol model and showing that it's a nice model but quite limited, and you have to protect yourself against the model itself, and which means that you have to develop a refined volatility hedge. So it's obtained by developing this volatility expansion and decomposition of the volatility through strikes and maturities, plus something that that is quite new, which is with a different measure of risk, actually it's going to give us not only the optimal hedge with vanilla options, but also a measure of the residual risk. So in other words, it gives you a measure of the hedgeability of a complex option with simpler ones. So this is very important because students or professionals, they understand or they admire that the cornerstone of option pricing, it is the ability to replicate, to eliminate the risk through dynamic hedging. This allows you to have a unique arbitrage-free price in the case of a complete market. Obviously, the real world is not at all complete, or most of the models considered in finance are not complete, and it's a fundamental question to know how hedgeable a complex option is with simpler ones. Just to give you examples, if you have an option that depends on X and Y, two stocks, it could be a basket option or a spread option. Imagine you have at your disposal options on the components on X and options on Y. How can you use them to sort of approximate, to get closer to your target? So the problem is that actually the spread option will be very hard to approximate, to hedge with this options on the components, whilst the basket option will inherit a very nice hedge. So this is a very important concept to know how hedgeable an option is. It's only if it's highly hedgeable that the notion of risk-neutral pricing makes sense, and this kind of notions usually are totally ignored by practitioners, and they will just calibrate a model, price the complex option with it, even if there is no valid hedge. In this case, it means they are making just very wild bet on something which on a totally uncontrollable risk. So I will show some examples of those concepts with different classical options. So functionally to calculus first. So conceptually, if you look at the relationship between a cause and a consequence. So let's say here X would be the cause and Y is the consequence, and F is the link between them. What you observe is that most of the time, this relationship is not at all instantaneous. It's more cumulative, or you have threshold effect, or it's differential. Just to give them simple examples, if you're interested in global warming, and you try to relate the level of the water to the temperature, so obviously it does not depend on the current temperature, but in a complex way on a history of freezing, defreezing, all this. In finance, we have very explicitly path dependency, which appears because it's, for instance, in the term sheet of your complex product. So you know by contract that if this and that happens, you receive such a quantity. In biology or psychology, you see that most of the effects have sort of delays or cumulative phenomena. So for instance, a reaction to a vaccine indeed will depend on the previous exposures. Back to finance, for mortgage-backed securities, for instance, the prepayment rate will not depend on the current level of the rates, but on the history of the rates before. It has gone down before quite a lot. It has sort of already creamed up a big section of the market of people who were susceptible to prepay. So let's say the natural for natural phenomena or in finance, the link between the cause and the consequence is pretty much systematically path dependent. However, the classical Ito calculus is considering essentially the evolution of the function, I mean how a function of the current state of the process evolves when the process itself is moving. When you look at it's what essentially Ito's lemma tells you. So here we develop a framework where we do the same thing, so not with a function of the current value of the process, but a function of the history of the current path so far. There will be some similarity with the Malleavian calculus for those who are familiar with this, but substantial differences. Malleavian calculus looks at functionals, but as let's say functions of a path of a fixed maturity, let's say of the final maturity, and you will apply some shocks to this path to see how it's affecting the functional. Here, we work on paths which are built along the way. It's just the way your uncertainty is revealed to us. We know the path so far, we don't know the future, and we cannot change the past because it's already past. Only thing you can do actually is to generate some local scenarios if you want between today and tomorrow, and I will explain in which sense. So to try to explain the difference between different approaches, if you look at a classical Ito setting in one dimension, so in this case, so the color code here is that black is the current value of the process, and red it's possible values, let's say tomorrow. So here, if you start here, tomorrow it may be up or down, and here I'm not. What I'm showing it's essentially different frameworks where you make different assumptions on the possible evolutions. So here it's a 1D case. In the ND case, so you could imagine you have five stocks, for instance, the five values are like this today, and here it's examples of realizations tomorrow. You could increase the number of dimensions or move to a continuum, like here in the infinite dimensional case. You can imagine that, for instance, the red curve, the black curve, it is the current yield curve. And the two red ones are example of possible curves tomorrow. And in this case, you can still have an Ito formula. Here it was a quadratic form, the Ito term, the quadratic form of the dimension n. Here, actually, so conceptually, you're evolving in a functional space. Each point is a yield curve, and you have a diffusion in the space, and you can still compute Ito's lemma. Malleavian calculus, so the deformations we are considering, so as I mentioned, here we have, let's say, time zero and time cap t here, and the Malleavian derivative consists, so at time t, that applying a small shift to a shock to the trajectory, and let's say in the Brownian case, to make it simple, so it propagates into just a parallel shift until the end. If you have a functional, which is something that associates to a whole path of real value, then this shock will impact the value of the functional, and you can compute the derivative with respect to a shock at 10 t, and you can repeat it for all possible intermediate times. What we are doing here with the functional intercalculus, as I said, it's we are not changing the past. The past is known and cannot be touched, and we don't know the future so far, but we just make some local assumptions between, let's say, time small t and t plus delta t here, with here two possible, two examples of possible evolutions. And the notion of functionals we will work with, it's a function that associates to a path, or if you want a running path or subpath, a real value, and we will pay attention to, we'll try to understand how the value of this functional is changing when the path gets built little by little. So, notion of functionals. So I try not to be too heavy on the notation, but the main thing is that we will work with a union of spaces, because my paths, they grow through time. So it's not the classical framework where you have a well-defined time interval and different paths, different functions on this interval. Here, it's a small t that will grow through time. So I look for x, each small t, I look at a catalog or right continuous left limit functions from 0 t to r. Often it's denoted by capital D t. So we need, so it allows for jumps for technical reasons. And lambda here is a union of all of them. So a function, a functional, it's a function from this lambda to r. So it means to each possible path, it will give you a real value. So here I show you an example. For instance, the up to time t here, you have the black path. Let's say value 632. And if I extend it, if I look at the realization over tomorrow, here, let's assume have a value like 634, and it would be something like the, for instance, the average value, if you want, of the, of this, the y-axis here. We are paying attention to this increment of value of the functional, how it relates to the increment of the path itself. Just some notation here, we keep the capital letters for the full path, for the path so far, or the full path, I mean for path in general, as opposed to the small letters here, which correspond to the value of the path at a given time. So, for instance, if you have a process X, so capital XT means the path up to time T, and smaller XT is the value at time T. So, example of functionals. So, you can think of dozens of them. Typical functionals of interest for us, it will be, for instance, the conditional expectation of the final value. So, if you have a functional which is defined over the, in the classical sense over a full time interval, and if you have a dynamic model, a model of evolution between the current time small t and the future, then you are able to compute the conditional expectation of the final value knowing the path so far. So this defines a functional, because if you have a catalog path between 0 and small t, then you can compute the average price of the final payoff, which is defined from 0 to cap t, under this dynamic model. So something which is important, and it is that maybe your model is quite simple. Let's say it could be black Scholes or even Brownian motion, but your path so far may have discontinuities or behave in whichever way. So up to here, that's 0 t. But your model, if your model is Brownian, so it means we'll consider Brownian trajectories until the end. So only thing we need for the functional to be defined is that for any possible realization between small t and cap t, the union of this past path and of the future path is CADLAG. So it's just that we can define the notion of the final payoff for such such a path. So what is very important is that we don't need to assume that the past path was in the support of the model, if you want. It didn't need to be continuous, for instance. But so if you have a model that defines the future here, so it allows you to define the functional, because for any path up to here, I can compute a conditional expectation by, if you want, running my Monte Carlo between small t and cap t. And I will look at the evolution of this functional when the path moves. Another interesting example, it is super replicating. There is a gap here. Super replicating price. Actually, it's a kind of generalization of the conditional expectation I have here. If you don't have just one measure but a family of measure, you can do something similar. If I know the path so far, then I can look at, for instance, the maximum expectation over the different models for a final functional. And this leads to the notion of a super replicating price. Let's focus mostly on the conditional expectation of final value. So in practice, it means just the price of a path-dependent option knowing the path so far, and a model for the assumption until the end. The classical, most of the examples we see on the market actually depend on the finite, on the small number of state variables. So we exclude the time. So let's assume that dynamics are Markov. In this case, if it's a European type payoff, so it only depends on one more extra state variable, the current price. If it's an Asian, it would depend also on the average so far. If it's an option on a range, max minus min, then it will depend on the running max and running min, for instance. But you have some other examples where you have many more state variables, or virtually an infinite number of them. So it means that we'll need a different treatment than here. In those cases with few state variables, you can still write a PDE, essentially a Black-Scholes PDE in several dimensions, and you have associated numerical schemes based on finite difference. But with more state variables, it's not a case anymore. Or even a simple example, you have convertible bonds where a call will be, an option will be triggered if there is a time period of 30 days during which 20 days have been above a certain level. Basically, you're in dimension 30. If you want to do it exactly, you cannot with a classical method. So now we have defined the set of paths and the functionals. Now we are going to define the notion of derivatives. We have two directional derivatives, if you want, a vertical one or a price derivative or space derivative, and a horizontal or time derivative here. So this is not a very natural concept usually for mathematicians, because a natural framework is to have a continuous path, and here we create a discontinuity. And more seriously, there's one here. Yeah, usually they work on a well-defined space, time interval, and this derivative makes you go across different states, different spaces, if you want. But within this framework, those quantities are perfectly well defined. So here, it's the notion of a shock the associated notion of derivatives, the spatial derivative, which is noted with the delta x here, is the limit of the, this ratio classically. So what does it mean? I compute the value of my functional on this path with this red shock. I subtract the value without the shock. I divide by the amplitude of the shock and go to the limit. And the same thing here for the time derivative. Just one difference is that here the shock may be positive or negative. Here the shock has to be positive. So just to get a feel for what it means, if I look at here, it's three examples of functionals, and I look at the two derivatives. So if my functional is just xt, so the functional, the value for the current path is just the current value of the process. So indeed, if I shock the path by vertically here, it will the response of x, and so it's x itself, the derivative is 1. But the time derivative here is going to be 0, because I'm extending flatly the path without affecting the value. Now, if I have the integral here, it's the other way around, in the sense that if I bump the current value, it's not affecting the integral, so it's 0. But here, if I freeze the current value here, so it will increment the integral by the current value xt times delta t. When you go to a limit, you get there. For quadratic variation, which is not defined over the whole set, but when it's defined, and then what you find is that the space derivative will be twice the amplitude of the jump if you have one. You get 0 if it's if it's a continuous path. In the case where your functional actually is kind of a Markov, in the sense that the value, the path, the value of functional depends on the path only through the current value of the path, of the process and the time, then those functional derivatives correspond to the classical partial derivatives. But you have, just in passing, interesting properties. So far we have not talked of any probabilistic framework, so it's really a functional setting here, framework. But in general, if you have a function of two variables, f of x and y, indeed you cannot decompose it into the sum of two functions, one depending only on x and the other one only on y. But in the functional framework, actually, you do manage to do it. If you have a function that depends on the path so far, you can write it as a sum of two functions, one with no spatial derivative and the other one with no time derivative. So topology and continuity. Slight technical difficulty here is that as we work with a space of paths which have different, possibly different lengths, so you have to account for that. So the distance that we choose here, so in this case x is the black path, it's shorter shorter duration than the red or white path. So in this case, what do we do? So the notation here, it means that you extend the x path flatly over a time interval s minus t. So it's the one with the dotted one here. So now they have the same length, and you compute the L infinite norm here, and to make sure it's a distance and not a semi distance, you have to add up the difference here. So you define the continuity according to this. This topology, and then what we get is this functional Itô formula, which under some technical and classical assumptions, it tells you that you can write the current value or the final value as the initial one plus the classical three Itô terms. So there is no surprise, nothing shocking here. The only thing is that is the interpretation of the derivatives, which is fundamentally different than in the Markov case. So, or the more concise notation is this one. Just to give you just a feel for the proof, which you can find in my SSRN paper, which is an elementary proof. So actually, it's not even using the classical Itô's formula. So it's a painful one, but which is basically starting from scratch. But to simplify everything, so conceptually, it's this decomposition that we are using. So df, so the change of value in the functional, it's the value after t plus delta t plus dt minus the value at t. So here you should add up everywhere a black path so far between 0 and t, but to make it simpler, I just show it as depending on the path between t and t plus delta t. So it's this is the difference, which is decomposed into three components. So the first one actually in the limit will go to zero. So you assume, so which corresponds to saying that you're just arriving. So you assume that you arrive at this point crudely by going flat and then vertically. The other component here, it is the contribution of this vertical shock here. And the last one, it is a time derivative. So the first time, the first term here under some assumptions will go to zero when delta t goes to zero and in a cumulative way. The second one here will contribute to actually the spatial derivatives of order 1 and 2. And the third one is a classical theta, if you want, the time derivative. So we get the functional Feynman-Katz formula here. So as I said, it's functional or path dependent in two different ways. One is that the dynamics themselves here are functional. So it means that the drift and the volatility may depend on the path so far, but still without being anticipative. So now if you have G, which is a final functional here, so you may look at it as a path-dependent option, as given by the, let's say, your contract that tells you how much you get according to what happened. So from a final functional here, you can build a functional on all the subpaths here by computing the conditional expectation. So you can use the discounting in a classical way here. The expectation is taking under, so to make it clearer, well, what the conditioning means here, it is that you know the path so far, so between 0 and t, it is the known path y. And for the future, we run the dynamics that we have here, built from this known path from the past here. Technically, there is a subtle distinction between conditional expectation and what we have here, which is more precisely a conditioned expectation, in the sense that, as I mentioned before, as you saw on this little graph here, the conditioning path here does not need to have been generated by the dynamics. For instance, if we are in the just Bachelier model, I can still compute a conditional expectation of the option, knowing the path so far, even if the path so far was not in the support of the probability. Actually, it is beneficial to introduce probabilities as late as possible and to first focus on the functional framework as opposed to start from to begin from the start with an omega space So, sorry, so just the Feynman-Katz formula. So we get structurally the same shape than the classical Feynman-Katz result. So here it tells you that the conditional expectation satisfies, in this case, a functional PDE. So again, two path dependencies, one in the dynamics and the other one in the functional here, so which means the function whose conditional expectation we are computing, the G here. So one application of this, by the way, it is that we have an alternative representation of the martingale representation result. So when we remove the drift terms, when we apply the functional Itô formula and we remove the drift terms thanks to the functional Feynman-Katz, we are left with actually a martingale, and here it is, it tells us that you can write the final payoff in this as an initial expectation plus this stochastic integral here, which is the martingale representation result, and it's very similar to the Malievin calculus Clark or Cohen formula, which gives you the same result here. So essentially, the integrand in the martingale representational theorem is shown to be an expectation of the Malievin derivative. The result I get here, it is that more directly, that it is the spatial derivative of this, of the conditional expectation. So if you prefer here, it is the differential of an expectation, and the derivative of an expectation, and here it's an expectation of a derivative. But this has the benefit of being defined in more generally, because the conditional expectation has a smoothing effect. So you smooth first before you you differentiate, as opposed to the Malievin expression here, which in many cases can still be defined, but in a weak sense. For a trader, this corresponds very simply to the delta of the option. The two derivatives I've been introducing for traders, they are much more natural than for the mathematician. The delta x will be the classical delta of the option, and the delta t, the time derivative, is the theta of the option. By the way, going back to the classical hedging argument in Black-Scholes here, so this is what I used to call probably the simplest, the single most important slide for really for the junior trader. So here on the left hand side, so you have the spot price, the current value here, and the blue line is the value of the call today for different possible values of the spot price. So it's this blue curve. The delta hedge corresponds to the first order linear approximation here, the black line, and the red curve here depicts the value of the call tomorrow. So you have essentially lost the theta here. So if you're long the option and you delta hedge, so you sell essentially this black line, so your P&L, your wealth tomorrow, the change of your wealth will depend on whether the red curve is above or below the black. So you look at the difference, red minus black, and you get this gamma profile here, this this variation of P&L as a function of variation of the spot price. If it doesn't move, you lose the theta. If it moves, you gain thanks to the gamma and the break-even points that makes you even. Yeah, so no profit, no loss. They're located one standard deviation away. So essentially what the functional PDE, pricing PDE tells you is that the same situation will prevail also in the case of past dependent options. So it's the result that that we have here. So which is that the theta will be compensated in average by the gamma, as explained here. So maybe it's better to ignore interest rates and carry terms here and focus on the first two. So this would be the theta of the option, and here the gamma, the classical gamma theta trade-off. Only thing is that it is an equation in infinite dimensional space because it's in the space of the of this running path. So to understand what it means, so if I write instead, yeah, delta t f is equal to minus half the the gamma here. It means that in my infinite dimensional space, if I'm at the current values, the path so far, the possible evolutions between today and tomorrow, they are locally one-dimensional. You have one Brownian driver. You are in the space of dimension, infinite dimension, but locally you will just move along one line, and you have to essentially integrate along this line with a Gaussian density to find the value of the option delta t before. Maybe I would sort of I should probably kind of skip this. I mean, it's just to explain that you do manage to find back in the functional system setting the classical results for the low dimensional path dependent options, and you do obtain eventually the slightly more involved PDEs, and by changing variables you can sort of recenter them and get something better, but I have to carry on. Robust vol hedge. So here it's probably the most concise slide you can imagine about a local wall model. So simplest model to fit a full surface. So the market gives you prices of European options to different strikes and maturities. If you're a market maker, you have to be ready to provide quotes for any possible strikes and maturities. So it means you need to have at your disposal a whole surface. So what the local vol model is doing, it is computing it's making some kind of a strange assumption on the instantaneous volatility as depending only on time and price, in such a way that it fits the market data. So one way to look at it is to say if the volatility is not constant, so you're not in Black-Scholes, if you reprice all the vanilla options, the corresponding volatility surface will not be flat anymore as it was in Black-Scholes. It will have some shape. And the question is, how can I tune actually this sigma of S and T in such a way that I hit my target, which is the market surface? So the nice result is that it's actually possible to do it explicitly by using the differential, the derivatives of the call prices through this equation here, or if you want, from this you can extract. You have two ways to look at it. Either you know this function and then you can compute in one sweep of a PDE all the call prices, the prices today of calls of all strikes and maturities, or the alternative angle is that if we know the call prices, then you're able to extract this local volatility, which is probably the main use of it. Other very important thing, and that's I think what Mateusz was saying in the sense that it's paradigm free, it's that it's much more than only fitting a parameter here and there that depends on spot and time to fit the market. It is actually, it has the status of forward quantity. It plays same role than for yield curve construction than instantaneous forward rates. Forward volatilities can be seen as instantaneous forward volatilities conditioned on a price level. To be more accurate, you have to work with the square of these quantities, and so you have actually sigma square will be the instantaneous forward variance conditioned on the price level. It plays the role of forward quantity in the sense that you can lock it in. If you compute it in this very friendly world where you would have all strikes and all maturities and no frictions, so if you compute a value for the local vol, by example, for instance, 20%, and if not, let's say, give a more striking example, 5%, and you find someone who is absolutely sure that it will be at least 10%, then you can enter a trade with that person and collecting money for sure. So it's values that you can lock in by arbitrage consideration. Just very quickly, the model itself, it's the very first step after Black-Scholes to fit the market. But it's very simplistic indeed. It assumes that there is no leeway, that at time T is a spot is S, then there is only one possible value for the instantaneous volatility. Indeed, we know volatility is stochastic and unpredictable, and it makes much more sense to add up some stochasticity in it as well. But the nice thing is that even if you do it, a stochastic vol model will be calibrated to the surface if and only if, in average, it behaves like the local vol. So you have this other result, that the conditional expectation of the instantaneous variance, knowing that you are at a certain spot price, it is the square of the local variance, of the local vol. So it's a very widely used model. It has, as I just said, this property. Another interesting property is that if you exclude the jumps, and if you make a deterministic assumption on the evolution of your model of implied vols, which traders do very often, they like to do it or they have to do it. For instance, the price moves by X, where will my implied volatilities be? And they have two classical assumptions. One, it's the sticky strike assumption, which means you have a skew like this, strikes are here, and if the spot price moves, then the volatilities do not move. A given strike will stay with the same volatility. Other assumption is sticky delta, which is that in moneyness terms, the skew doesn't change. So it means if the spot moves, the skew will move together. These kind of assumptions actually are arbitrageable. If you make a deterministic assumption, and if you do not have jumps, only viable one is the one given by the local vol model. So for practitioners here, here it's an example of local vols we get from the S&P. It was a pre-crash, actually. Those are implied vols, and we get local volatilities like this. It would deserve a full session, actually, the construction of the good implied volatility surface, because you have plenty of constraints, and it's wrong. What the market does most of the time is quite wrong, which is just fitting each maturity separately with a parametric form and trying to glue the different maturities together. Very, very often it creates arbitrage because you had to extrapolate in strike for each maturity, and very easily it's creating conflicts between maturities. I don't have time to go through this. So local vol model, it's a very, it's nice because it's very minimalistic but simplistic. It has the benefit of being a complete model, so theoretically means you have unique possible prices, no notion of risk premium and these kind of things. But it's a weakness as well. Any model which is complete cannot be a very good model, because indeed you know you will face evolutions of of the world which are escaping this very contrived evolution. So let's assume it's the only thing you have, this local vol model, and but you're aware of the weakness, and that you would like to hedge yourself not only within the model through the delta, but against the model, outside the model, or against the model, because you know that you're going to the realization of the vol surface tomorrow will most likely differ from what was predicted from today. So typically, you have to hedge against volatility perturbations and to ideally reach a decomposition of Vega across strikes and maturities, and which will give you the portfolio of your open options to optimally hedge your exotic option. One way to do it, and back at Paribas in 1994, I think we were doing it like this, you apply a smooth bump on the implied volatility surface, you compute the corresponding deformation of the local volatility, so you have a bump up and a bump down, because everything that has been increased here has to be compensated after to make sure that the strikes, and, I mean the maturities beyond the one where you applied the shock, the bump, are not affected, because here I don't want to affect the implied volatilities after. So I have a nice cancellation given through this. So you can, what you can do is to price your exotic option with the initial surface, and then after to reprice it with a bump in local volatilities like this. But it's very unstable numerically speaking, because you first have to define a grid of bumps in strikes and maturities. After, for each one of each such bump here, you need to have a numerical scheme, either PD or Monte Carlo, that samples finally the shape of that. Well, 5 minutes, and that's very difficult, but let's go. So here the nice thing is that we can have in simple models an analytical treatment to understand exactly what happens. So as I mentioned earlier, a way to compute the difference of price between two different models is to assume one model and hedge accordingly, but to experience actually another one, which creates deviations in the P&L. So what you do here, for instance, your base model is a local volatility model, and the real model may be a stochastic vol model. And so you had the functional PD here, and when you apply Itô's formula and apply in it the functional PDE, you get this term here. So this is a delta hedge. Initial. This is the price with the initial model, and this is the tracking error. If you just take the average expectation of this term, it will give you the difference of price between the two models, which is what we have here. This is the price of the G under the model V, and this is under the initial one. The difference can be seen as this double integral. It depends on how likely you get to X, to level X at time T, and it depends on, in average, on the difference of variance, instantaneous variance you have there, and it depends also on the gamma. This I skip. So this was not an infinitesimal expansion. It was exact for arbitrary bumps. But for now we are going to look at it in the case, and it was between local vol and stochastic vol. Here we are going to do local vol against local vol. So initial model is just with variance V0, and the other one with variance V0 plus U. What you obtain is the difference of price between the perturbed model here at the initial one, it's still this double integral here. M of XT is the sensitivity to the bump, because U is the bump itself here. And this M, this it's a kind of gradient, partial derivative, if you want. It is equal to, it depends on how likely it is to get there and what is the expected gamma that you have there if you get there. This was still not infinitesimal when you do it infinitesimally, so you have the benefit that it's actually a unique measure, not two of them, but have no real time to go there. So here it's some funky graphs that I will go over quickly. Maybe this one just a one-touch option. So it's an option that gives you $1 if you hit a certain level before maturity at any time. The gamma of the option is really concentrated at the end. So it mostly depends on so if you have not touched it before maturity, but you are close to there. The M here, which is a sensitivity to the local vol, it has this shape, have to multiply by the absorbed density, but still it's mostly dominated by the behavior of the local volatilities close to the maturity, close to the barrier at maturity here. And up and out call price, yeah, for instance, for up and out, yeah, it's beautiful, yeah, it's psychedelic, yeah, flower power, yeah. So here, actually, if you move from black shorts where the vols are flat to local vol where typically you have a negative skew, so it moves like this, so the local vols will increase here, and you have a positive sensitivity to it, so it will increase the price of the option, and it will decrease here where you have those negative values, negative sensitivities, which will increase even more the price of the option, which means that the local vol price can be higher than, the combined effect can push up the price so much that you would be unable to reach it with any Black-Scholes model with flat vol. Because here with Black-Scholes flat vol with zero vol, you are out of the money, zero value, you increase the vol, you capture value through the convexity of the strike, you increase the vol even more, you lose the option because it's almost sure it hits the barrier. Okay, this has to be very, I kind of need to skip it. I cannot go through the details, but just the idea is that to get the portfolio of your open options with the same risk signature as your target, so you're going to equate, so you want to cancel the risk sensitivities which are here, so you write it for your target and you write it for a portfolio of your open options, and it gives you actually a condition which is that the gamma of your option will have to match a certain function here, and you're able with some work to do it. This is the number of strikes of options of a certain strikes and maturities you need to use, and it's given as a source term of a certain PDE. So I give you an example here, Asian option. I give you directly the risk decomposition here. So the sensitivity to bumps in implied volatilities of different strikes and maturities, it's given by this. So not surprisingly, here it was in the example, it's an at-the-money Asian option on the average. So you have a sensitivity to at-the-money strikes for different maturities. This would correspond pretty much to the super replication of the Asian option with a portfolio of European options. But surprisingly, you have a negative exposure at mid-maturity to the strikes which are out of the money, which is something which was very hard to guess beforehand without this kind of analysis. So it allows you to decompose the risk, volatility risk of a complex option into simpler ones. If you have a portfolio of plenty of options, you can add up this representation of risk linearly to get actually a fine description of your volatility risk. Your open option would have a kind of Dirac at the strike and maturity, but for passive and options, usually the risk is spread. So you can add up all the risks and to see whether you're happy with the combined representation. You have a full landscape of risk. Just quickly here, if you have a forward parabola, the gamma is like this, and applying the formula, you find that the hedge is to buy all the strikes and maturity T2, sell and maturity T1, and this is with no risk. But for a cube, I have to go. Yeah, this is more fun. This is a cliquet option, forward start option. So those are the, it's the gamma, but the hedge, the corresponding hedge looks like this. You have to buy the protection in volatility. It corresponds to buying close to the money strikes at maturity T2 and to sell all the strikes at maturity T1. And kind of surprisingly, you have some sensitivities in between, where many people thought that actually it was not depending on the behavior in between. One touch, you have, as I just want to reach the new stuff, it's just a couple of slides here. What we've seen so far, it was the optimal hedge. If you want to protect your profit and loss, your P&L between today and tomorrow, against any possible shock variation of the deformation of the implied vol surface, but it's still a kind of a local view. If you want to understand better the risk or the ability to hedge your option until the end, you can do the following thing. Here we look at a simple case, like for instance you're in Bachelier model, but you create incompleteness by the fact that you only delta hedge once a day. When you do this, you have little risks every day that depend mostly on the gamma you encounter. If you have no gamma, you have no risk. High gamma, high risk. And you can show that the risk of the delta hedge position depends on the kind of average of the gammas here. And so you can compute it for your target option. You can compute it for your vanilla options, and you can sort of project your target onto the space of hedging instruments in this L2 sense here. And when you do it, what you find, actually, you find the same hedge as what we had before to be when you were protected between today and tomorrow. But in addition, what you get, it is an evaluation of the risk, of the residual risk. It gives you two things, the optimal projection, so the optimal hedge, but also the distance to the hedge, the residual risk. And actually, it depends on the variance of the, basically on how much the gamma is path dependent. If I look at a different path that would arrive at the same, if I look at a different path arriving at the same value here, so in general, they will have different gammas because it's path dependent. And it's the variability of this gamma here that will determine the hedgeability or not of the option. If there is no variability, then you can show that you can find a perfect European hedge. that's the notion I mentioned before, the good hedgeability and the bad hedgeability. And it's a measure I defined a few years ago, the H-squared, which is a measurement of the quality of the hedge, how much of the variance you absorb through the hedge, like the R-squared of the regression. And I'm almost there. Yeah, that's a nice summary here. So it allows you to create a risk scale of different options, of different path-dependent options here. You may normalize by the premium or not, but essentially, you find that with this measure, a down and out call, it's a bear option, but it's a well-behaved one, is even more, it's safer than a call, which is kind of similar to an Asian. And the worst things, it's out of the money barriers, like up and out call, for instance, here. So it's very important for a bank to understand the risk which is entailed taken when you trade this kind of instruments. And conclusion here, we've seen that it's possible to extend the Itô calculus to path dependent options, so by defining new kinds of derivatives, you can compute a difference of price between two different models, which gives you the actually a version of calculus on the volatility surface, because you can compute actually that if you view the price as a function of the initial volatility surface, you have a differential calculus on this, and we obtain this risk and maturity decomposition of the volatility risk plus an estimation of the residual risk. Thank you.